the session of Muslims and Christians at work. And what I want to try to do is to look a little bit more at some of the political aspects and the social aspects of Islam, particularly in the contemporary world. And I want finally to come to some places where very particularly Christians and Muslims are living in the same society, with the challenges and the problems and the opportunities that go with that. I've tried to divide the thoughts up under three main sections, and to deal with each section in usually a three-point sequence. Maybe this is my Methodist bringing coming out of me, having been brought up on three-point sermons. I tend now to produce three-point lectures. But I said to some of you last week, even when I am in full spate, don't hesitate to interrupt me and question me if things are getting out of hand. The three main aspects that I want to look at are, first of all, societies where Muslims are in the majority. Secondly, societies where Muslims are relatively balanced in numbers with people of other faiths, very often Christians. And thirdly, situations where Muslims are a minority alongside people of other faiths or ideologies. Again, sometimes Christian. And within each section, I want to look, where appropriate, at some of the different options that Muslims choose in trying to relate their faith to their daily life. Some of them aspire to what I would call an Islamic state, or an Islamic society, or an Islamic community. And I'm using that word Islamic there in a rather self-conscious way, which describes the way in which some Muslims are trying to bring back elements of legislation, elements of government support and even government control, they would say, to help them live their faith better. The second group that I shall look under each category are what I'd call people who are content rather with what they'd call a Muslim state, or a Muslim society, or a Muslim community, or a Muslim family, maybe, where the word is being used perhaps not in such an ideological sense as I was using it in the first category. Can I remind you that the word Muslim is simply just the adjective that goes with the word Islam. Islam is a word that we can spell with a capital I, and Muslim is a word that we can spell with a capital M. If we spell Islam with a capital I, it's, if you like, the name of a religion. If we spell Muslim with a capital M, it's the idea of the adherent of that religion. But never forget that you can spell Islam with a little I, and it simply means submission, or surrender to God, the idea of being surrendered to God. It's a verbal noun, if you like. And therefore, the adjective that comes from it, Muslim, again with a small m, for these purposes, is being surrendered to God, depending on God. And at that point, the word ceases to be the private possession of the Islamic community. It becomes a universal word. It becomes a word which sometimes Muslims will honour us as Christians with this word. They will say, well, you too are believers, you too are Muslim when you pray, when you give alms, when you turn to God. So this second option in society, I say, is one that is less ideological, less structured, less legalistic, but deeply concerned that the life of the nation, the community, the family, shall be lived under God. And the third option that I shall look at is what we may call a more secular approach to life. Sometimes this secularity is itself an ideology, what we may call secularism, where people are really and very deliberately opting to take out of politics, take out of society, to take out again maybe of family, community, the element of religion. Sometimes this secularism is anti-religious, sometimes it's perfectly neutral to religion. Sometimes I would say it is a very deliberate religious option, where some Muslims are saying, we want to be Muslim, maybe even we want to be as Islamic as we can, but for us, this doesn't prevent us from living in a secular state, this doesn't prevent us from deconfessionalizing a lot of society. Now let's quickly go to these three major groupings that I've indicated across the Muslim world, because we must all be aware how utterly impossible it is to make sweeping generalizations about the Islamic world or the Muslim, given the enormous variety and complexity of a community that is anything between 700 million and some would say 900 million in today's world. Incidentally, any of you who are particularly interested in statistics and really want to get to the bottom of who is where and so on, there is a magnificent new ethnographical study put out, I believe, by a scholar from the University of Austin in Texas, a man called Richard Weeks, and it's basically a standard reference work called Muslim Peoples, and it gives you the breakdown right across the world of these demographic factors. But first of all, let's take an introductory look at these situations where Islam is a majority faith. Some people would say this is what it ought to be. Some people would say Islam is essentially a faith that operates in the circumstances of being a majority. But I already reminded some of you, as we looked at the slides the other evening, that in fact, in history, some of the largest numbers of Muslims have lived, and even still live, as minorities in relation to other citizens of other faiths. We've only got to start totting up, as we'll see when we come to the minority groupings, how many they are. But the ideal picture is, in many Muslims' minds, the sort of situation that has obtained in Arabia. Arabia, from the time of Islam, was declared an Islamic peninsula. Incidentally, that has been changed, though it's not very readily acknowledged. It has been changed quite substantially in the process of modernizing the Arabian, Saudi Arabian economy. And there are now surprisingly large numbers, not only of European and American technicians, either actively or nominally Christian, but surprising numbers of Coptic Egyptian workers, Korean Christian construction workers, Korean Buddhist construction workers, people from South India who may be Hindu or may be Christian, etc., etc., working in Saudi Arabia. But basically, Saudi Arabia we think of as the classic Islamic state. And there's no need for me to go into some of the details that certainly capture the imagination of most journalists. We always get pictures on our TV screens when there is the occasional amputation of a thief or flogging somebody who's been selling bootleg liquor or whatever. It's in many ways a very untypical Islamic state. Some of my Saudi Arabian friends wouldn't like me to say that, but I think we have to register that it is an untypical Islamic state, not only in the present day, but also across history. Because right across history, there have been relatively few instances where you've had this very strong religious control of a lot of the public and private legislation. There are all sorts of grey areas in Saudi Arabian life, particularly connected with the behavior of the royal family. Many good Muslims in Saudi Arabia very worried at the conspicuous consumption that goes on with some of the staggeringly wealthy royal family. Many of them worried about the fact that although they may not invest their money
in usurious banks in Saudi Arabia. Many of them have numbered Swiss bank accounts, etc., etc. Other self-consciously Islamic states in this majority grouping would of course include two of the largest Islamic nations in the world, Pakistan and Bangladesh, both of which came into being as new states, well, originally as one state, West and East Pakistan, but subsequently as two states, came into being with this self-conscious decision to be amongst their brothers and sisters as Muslims in the subcontinent of India. It involved some of the largest exchanges of population that we've seen in our lifetime. It involved, incidentally, a horrifying death toll on both sides, where Sikhs and Hindus went on the rampage slaughtering Muslims, and where Muslims went on the rampage slaughtering Sikhs and Hindus. There are still many Muslims, both in Pakistan and Bangladesh and in India, who were traumatized by the events of partition. And Pakistan and Bangladesh have both had very checkered careers. They have gone through various styles of government, some of them almost secular, Western democratic style governments, some of them straightforward martial law regimes. One of the latest twists that you will be aware of is with the present president of Pakistan, Zia-ul-Haq, who came to power with a military coup overthrowing the democratically elected Bhutto. The history behind that takeover is still not fully known, but certainly part of the objection to Bhutto was that there was an element of socialist policy in Bhutto. Zia, on the other hand, is very much supported by the 10 families, as they're called in Pakistan, the enormous landowners and industrialists who are controlling a vast sector of the Pakistani economy. One of the twists of the latest Afghan adventure is that Zia is stronger than he's ever been. And what is happening in the state of Pakistan at the moment is a new, very self-conscious Islamizing process where all sorts of options that were previously there, sometimes for the minorities, the tiny Christian minority, the very small sectarian Ahmadi minority, these minorities are having at the moment a very rough ride, and the very strict Saudi Arabian type policies are being introduced and even imposed. Bangladesh is a more secular type model, but it is still also in many ways self-consciously Islamic, though not in such a shrill way as I sometimes feel contemporary Pakistan. Other countries to mention are obviously Iran, though I remind you that Iran's form of Islamic revolution is of a very special and different sort. Since several of us spent quite a long time talking about Iran at the forum on Monday evening, where quite legitimately a lot of you declared your interests immediately, I don't think I should go very much over that ground. But let me remind you that this religious Islamic revolution, in the case of Iran, has been very much a popular revolution, rejecting the monarchy, rejecting again the very powerful bourgeoisie that had developed in Iran. But it's too soon to see exactly where it will be going. Libya is another very different example and its type of self-conscious Islamic state. The ruler of Libya, Colonel Gaddafi, came to power overthrowing a somewhat corrupt monarchy and rejected over-dependence either on the capitalistic world or the communist world. And with his little green book and so on, announced a third way of Islamic state. But what is strikingly different in Gaddafi's definition of what is Islamic
is that his is a much more community-based and a much more, socialistic style of Islamic State. Social justice has been the major appeal of Gaddafi, and he has used his military power to produce in a very short time a rather unusual style of state. I don't want to take strong value judgments about it. Suffice it to say that it is probably a country in the whole world which has the narrowest income gap between the rich and the poor. The rich are virtually no longer there. The rich who left, as you know, to live in Europe and so on, have recently been hounded down in a particularly lurid and unpleasant form of witch hunt. The distribution of income, and it's a large income that comes from Libyan oil, has produced a situation that I described to some people as it being almost impossible to find any basic poverty. The Little Sisters of Jesus, whom I mentioned the other day as Catholic missionaries whose vocation is to live with Muslims and especially with very poor Muslims. When I visited them in Libya, they said, you know, we can't find any slums to live in. We've looked everywhere. We've looked in the towns, we've looked in the deserts, we've looked in the villages. And everybody lives in neat little houses, very often air-conditioned. Everybody has at least one and probably two cars outside. Some of the friends who've been here in the village teaching in Libya have described some of this to some of us. Now, all of this is done in the name of Islam, and it's a very different style from what you see in Saudi Arabia. Two other countries that I'll just mention at this point, which are not yet Islamic states, but which might become Islamic states. They're two of the most populous Islamic states in the world. One is Indonesia, where you have various estimates about the number of Muslims, but it's certainly round the 90% mark. But 90% out of well over 100 million people, probably 130 million, still leaves 10 to 15 million people who are not Muslims. And those 15 million people who are many of them Christian, but some of them still Buddhist or Hindu, and a few of them still belonging to the traditional religion, they are somewhat disquieted by some of the policies that are being put forward in the Islamic community in Indonesia to try to make Indonesia an Islamic state. Now, I don't want to take a position on this, but I think it's something we should be very sensitive about. The greatest problem here is that these religious minorities in Indonesia, notably the Christians, tend to live in local situations, in West Irian, in the Moluccas, in East Timor, and so on. And in a local situation, the Christians may be the majority. In a local situation like Bali, it's the Hindus who are a majority. And so in these local situations, there is considerable anxiety. What would it mean if there is an Islamic state in Indonesia? What one would hope, I think, is that it was an Islamic state that really obeyed the letter of the Islamic law, which does provide proper dispensation for the minorities. What one would hope it was not was the sort of rather fanatical style of Islamic State that has appeared at some points in history. Egypt is another situation where there is a very strong pressure at the moment for an Islamic State. And as you know, Sadat has been pushing recently to declare Egypt as an Islamic State. And this is very worrying for some would say approximately 15% of the population who are Coptic Orthodox and a handful of evangelicals. Once again, it's very difficult to know how to counsel Christians in a situation like this. Should one press the panic button? Should one say that an Islamic state is by definition an unjust society, an autocratic society, etc., etc.? That could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. we may have to take a line which says, and this is what some of my Egyptian Christian friends will say to me, we may have to take a line that says, if this is the majority will in a country, the minority may have to accept it, but try not to feel too much as a minority. Try to feel as much as possible, fellow citizens, and try to exploit to the full all those loopholes in Islamic law which, at least in theory, provide freedom for the minorities. Now I must race on, as I'm taking too long over this, but these majority countries are, after all, the main sector of the Islamic world. Very briefly, let's turn to those Muslim countries, rather fewer in number, who I would say have certainly not gone for a self-conscious Islamic state, but still recognize themselves as Muslim in their culture, still find the whole of society impregnated by Muslim norms. I'm thinking, for example, of the North African countries, each very different in their turn, of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, but all of them emerging under different circumstances from French control, and all of them in many ways being highly modern states, with mobile populations, lots of education still going on in the French language, lots of people almost commuting between North Africa and France, legislation that is in many ways much more Napoleonic than Islamic, and with the exception of some pressure groups, little trend to produce the full-blown Islamic state ideology. And yet, a very strong consciousness that they're Muslim. And these are churches, for example, where there are almost no indigenous people belonging to any other religion. These North African countries are, to a greater extent than the Middle East countries, 99% Muslim. In the case of the Middle East countries, there are almost always substantial Christian or other minorities. And maybe it's because these are 99% Muslim countries that it's easier for them simply to accept the fact that they're Muslim and then have a greater freedom to play around with options to modernize, to adapt, to reform even their faith. So you get in the North African countries, for example, feminist movements who have succeeded far more than in some other Muslim countries, for example, to prohibit plural marriage, polygamy, and to make divorce laws much more equally applicable to men and women, so that women can appeal and initiate divorce proceedings and not only men. Theoretically, women have always been able to do that, but it's been so tied up in red tape that it's been almost impossible, and also they're pressed for alimony provisions and so on. Jordan is another country in the Middle East, almost entirely Muslim, apart from a small Christian minority, that takes this route of not being excessively self-conscious as an Islamic state, but nevertheless, the Muslim culture is very strongly there, and particularly in the case of Jordan, you have the two components. You have the Bedouin culture, which is a strange amalgam of Islam, but also of the pre-Islamic desert culture, never entirely obliterated, and you get the urban culture, which is in many ways somewhat secularized. Quick examples now of the third category that I was going to give you among these majority Muslim states. The third category are those who have gone the route of the secular state. The most striking of these is the state of Turkey. And you remember way back in the 1920s, under the leadership of Kemal Atatürk, there was a very thoroughgoing secularist revolution in Turkey, finally overthrowing the Ottoman emperors, the sultans, with all those monarchical and feudal traditions that had carried on, looking very deliberately towards the West, a lot of deliberate westernizing coming in, even to the point of making people throw away their fezes and wear a flat cap like the Lancashire mill workers wore, or the golfers in Scotland, depending on how smart the cap was. A process whereby women were prohibited from wearing the veil, same as I told you when I showed you the slides, happened in Central Asia under the Russian government, and in Iran under the Shah's, the former Shah's father. A process too where the lands that belonged to the mosques and the Islamic institutions were very largely nationalized, where Islamic education was strictly controlled and checked, all the Quran schools, the use of Arabic and so on, closed down, an attempt to translate and use, well not, it had already been translated, the Quran, into Turkish, but only as a tool, never as the real thing. And now for the first time people heard the call to prayer from the minaret in Turkish and were asked to use the Turkish Quran in the mosque, a deeply shattering experience for many Muslims. And something that lasted for a surprisingly long time, right through into the 1950s, when finally there was a backlash, and some of you may know that there is now a whole new conservatism and a religious conservatism that has come up in Turkey. But technically it's still a secular state. The socialist countries of Iraq and Syria are also, in many ways, self-conscious secular states, predominantly Muslim. It's very interesting that the Ba'ath Socialist Party, which rules in those two countries, was founded by a Christian. And we must remember that many Christians in the Middle East have been foremost in the leadership of trying to establish new models of statehood other than an Islamic state. Middle Eastern Christians have especially looked towards the West, have encouraged Westernization, sometimes in very obvious forms, such as the Maronites of Lebanon, of whom more in a minute, but also sometimes in terms of saying, let's take the ideas of the West, but make something new for ourselves. And that's what has happened with this particular form of Arab socialism, which is both Islamic and Christian in countries like Iraq and Syria. Let's not forget either the very short-lived experiment, although I may be wrong, maybe it will be more than short-lived, maybe it will be enduring, of Afghanistan. Because when Afghanistan had its revolution a few years ago and once again overthrew its monarch and overthrew its feudal powers, Afghanistan for several years went the route of a secular state with attempts at democracy and so on, avoiding martial law solutions. And it was into that situation of trying to bring about a secular state in Afghanistan, 99.9% Muslim, that finally the government failed to work on its own and turned to the big brother in the north for military help for what was probably a tottering regime. We all know the Pandora's box that has opened. Let me just say in parenthesis here that I'm inclined to think that we've had double standards in our outrage about that Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. I don't defend it for a moment, but I think we sometimes forget that it was on the basis of an invitation from the then ruling Afghan government. The damning factors, of course, are that when the military support came, it was in many ways a sledgehammer to crack a nut, at least so it seemed at first. But by that overkill approach of the Soviets, bringing in far more military than was justifiable in the circumstances, it then unleashed a tremendous backlash, precisely from those feudal interests that had been lying low under the new secular governments, and especially when there was somebody like Zia-ul-Haq across the border in Pakistan, then there was no stopping the escalation of violence on both sides. I think, in a sense, Afghanistan may be the USSR's Vietnam, but let me remind you that these interventions in other people's domestic politics, sometimes at the invitation of the government, as in the case of Vietnam, as in the case of Afghanistan, are highly ambiguous, morally and in every other sense. Well, there is a quick survey of where most of the Muslims in the world live. But let's turn more quickly to the other somewhat anomalous situations, anomalous as Muslims see them. To the situations where there is a balance an almost equal balance between the Muslims and citizens of other faiths. Look first, within this category, at places where, despite this, there is a push for an Islamic state. Notably the case of Malaysia. Less than 50% of the population of Malaysia, west and east, are Muslim. But for reasons of the handover from the British Empire and so on, it is the Malay Muslim rulers who are in control. And the enormous number of Chinese Buddhists, of Hindu, Tamil plantation workers, and substantial number of Christians, mainly of Chinese and Indian extraction. These other 50% of the population, I should have added also within that 50%, the traditionalists, especially in East Malaysia, those who have never adopted a monotheistic or other world religion. Malaysia tries to impose an Islamic state pattern over this very pluralist society. And for the most part, it works. I can't go into the details now, but precisely because there is this balance between the Muslims and the others, the Islamic law, as applied in Malaysia, is applied pretty scrupulously to affect only the Muslims, those aspects of the law which are particularly Islamic. And all the other communities are given their own modes of basically secular dispensation. Another country which we may think of where there is a strong push for an Islamic state, despite, and for Islamic law, and for lifting up the Islamic ideology, despite the fact that the Muslims are probably less than half the total population, is Nigeria. And this very much depends upon who the ruler of Nigeria is, because there's been a sort of swing of the pendulum. One moment it's been a Muslim ruler, one moment it's been a Christian ruler. But there is a very strong pressure, supported by Saudi Arabia, to make northern Nigeria, with its strong Islamic culture, much more dominant in the overall conduct of Nigeria. And you remember that that pressure for an Islamic state from the north was one of the factors, the only one, that triggered off the civil war of 10 or more years ago, when there was also, of course, the factor of oil and the fact that most of the oil was in the Christian area. And at that point, there was a pressure for a separate, mainly Christian state in the south, Biafra. And that never succeeded. And many Christians think it would have been a mistake for it to have succeeded. Many Christians believe that the vocation of Christians in a country like Nigeria is to learn to live better with their Muslim neighbours. But it isn't always made easier when there is this sometimes rather shrill pressure for an Islamic state. Places where I would describe Muslims living in shared communities, accepting the situation that they must, yes, be Muslim, but nevertheless relate inequality with neighbours, would include countries like Sudan, would include perhaps the prevailing opinion in a place like Eritrea, part of Ethiopia, which is 50% Christian and 50% Muslim, more or less. In places like this, I don't see a strong pressure for an Islamic state, although I remind you again that in a previous generation, the fact that some Muslims in Sudan went the way of trying to produce an Islamic state was contributory to the civil war in Sudan. And one of the agreements that was achieved, incidentally, to the mediating processes of the All Africa Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches, the peace settlement some 10 years ago in the Sudan was very much around the principle that the Muslims could be Muslim and the Christians could be Christians and the animist could be animist. And it was a shared type of government, a more federal type of government. Many people looking at a solution for Ethiopia would also, if they try to keep the country as a united country, go back to something that was tried for a short time under Haile Selassie, but unfortunately not tried hard enough, namely a sort of federal solution which admitted that certain parts needed maybe Christian governors and so on, but equally well other parts, such as Ogaden in the south or Eritrea in the north, needed and still need Muslim leadership, opportunities for Muslims to take responsibility, and so on. So these states where there is a half and half situation are very often the flashpoints and the trouble points. But not always. There are other places that I'd like to mention briefly where I think a sort of harmony has been achieved between the Christians and Muslims sharing the same state, involved in the same nation building struggles. I can't go into details now, but I think of Tanzania, where they've taken a more secular approach, the third option. They've taken Ujamaa socialism, which in many ways is an Islamic idea. The values of community, the values of sharing, and a very self-conscious government policy to mix up the Christians and the Muslims. I've been in villages in Tanzania where for the very first time busloads of Christians have been plonked down in a Muslim area, and the Lutheran pastor has had to go around and meet the imam, and the imam has said, well, we'll help you build your church. And eventually the Christians have helped the Muslims to expand their Muslim school, and a really impressive form of partnership has developed. Doesn't always happen. I've been in other villages in Tanzania where I've said to the local pastor, again a Lutheran in this instance, who's a bishop actually, could we meet the local imam? Oh yes, he said, I've been here for 20 years and always meaning to do that. And we had a marvellous time together when we did meet, and I hope it's happened again since then. But it's possible for Christians and Muslims to live side by side in that state and never meet. But the real model is of meeting and sharing. Now, the last word to say on this middle category of countries where Muslims live alongside other neighbours is to refer you to two particular problematic situations. One is Lebanon. Because Lebanon is not a secular state, is not an Islamic state. It's a confessional state with a constitution that has tried to think of everything and divide everything up in a very, very sort of ounce of flesh spirit. This goes to the Christians, this goes to the Muslims, this goes to the Druze community, and so on and so forth. It worked well for quite a long time, but we also know that it's been a disastrous failure in recent years. Particularly when people have used that confessional principle not to work together for one state, but to try to carve the state up into shared confessionalisms, but isolated confessionalisms. And this is the tremendous travail and turmoil and tragedy of the Lebanon at the moment. Many Lebanese, as I said the other evening, particularly those non-Catholic, non-Roman Catholic Christians related to the Orthodox churches and Protestant churches, are convinced that they must try and make the policy of partnership work. Many Muslims are committed to the policy of partnership. There are extremists on both sides, Christian and Muslim. The other special case is Israel and Palestine, where the dream of many on both sides was a shared community. Yes, a national home for the Jews, but yes, also a place that did not violate the rights of other inhabitants of that country. And for a whole variety of reasons, with blame, I would say more or less equally to be apportioned on both sides, that sharing has not worked. On the Palestinian side, there has also been a dream of sharing. In this case, a secular state where Christians, Muslims, and Jews would live together, whatever the boundaries were, whether the original total Palestine or some half Palestine. There too, the vision has got blurred, and more it is hard to imagine in any future Palestine state, and I think we must begin to start planning for a future Palestine state. It's hard to imagine how that future Palestine state will accommodate Jews. It will accommodate Muslims and Christians. Equally well, it's hard to see how Muslims and Christians will go on in the state of Israel if what many people regard, including many Jews, as somewhat extremist policies of present Begin government continue. Because while one may accept second-class citizenship for a while, there comes a point of final desperation. I'm sorry to have to deal with that case so elusively, but I'd rather thought it would come up in the forum the other evening, and it didn't. But let me remind you that here is one of these tinderbox situations where Christians, Muslims, and in this case a third partner, Jews, are living together. Some people with very much a confessionalist solution to bring. Okay, let's have the Jews on their own and the Muslims on their own, and probably the Christians can just get lost somewhere. They can emigrate to the States or Australia or be shipped into Lebanon or whatever. There are others, nevertheless, who say the city of Jerusalem was always a shared city. It should still be a shared city. The Holy Land was a shared land. It should still be a shared land. How can we? I believe that truer vision of sharing to be fulfilled. The last category I want to touch upon in this somewhat schematic carving up of the Muslim world is the situation that we shouldn't overlook, where Muslims are a minority. Where Muslims are a minority, sometimes with considerable power. I remind you of the situation where you get suddenly a Muslim ruler coming to power in an African country like Uganda or Cameroon, and where at least for a time it seems that even this Islamic State formula will be produced. I remind you of situations where in an overall nation the Muslim group is a very small minority. I'm thinking of the Philippines. But where even though they are a tiny minority, they still cling to the vision of re-establishing an Islamic state and Islamic rule. They can do this partly because they are an island people. The Muslims of the south have certain little pockets of almost 100% Islamic population, the Sulu archipelago, the Basilan island, and even parts of Mindanao are still very strongly Muslim. But through policies of the Marcos government, particularly, enormous numbers of contrived and almost forced immigration has taken place into the south. And great parts of Mindanao, which were once Muslim, are now almost overrun with Christians. That vision of an Islamic state will almost certainly not work. And therefore many of the more moderate Muslims in the Philippines would work more towards some sort of federated situation. I'll say a bit more about the Philippines tomorrow when I talk about Christian-Muslim dialogue, because it is a very special situation where you have a very strong and self-consciously Christian country, the Philippines, responsible for some of the worst abuses against Muslims anywhere in the world. I've only been there two or three times, but every time I go, I'm repelled by what I see and shamed as a Christian. The second category among the minorities of Muslims across the world are those Muslims who really almost opt out of the surrounding society and try to live somewhat separate lives within the overall secular or Christian or whatever state. There are a few instances of this. You might say that this is very much the situation which is being forced upon at least many religiously minded Muslims in Europe or the United States, to try to set up little Muslim islands. When I was in Chicago a few years ago, not only did I find this mentality among some of the world community of Islam in the West, formerly called black Muslims, who, as you know, have bought up whole blocks of the city and live together in a little homogeneous Muslim community, but meeting with the Arab and Turkish and other Muslim leaders in the Chicago area, they told me, yes, we've chalked out an area in southern Chicago and we are trying to buy homes there. We're trying to get all the scattered Muslim community to come together in a little Muslim island, because we want them to have education facilities, we want them to have the proper kosher type food, etc., etc. The same thing is happening in Europe. There are parts of big German cities where 95% of the children in the local schools are Muslims. The same pattern is being reproduced in British cities, in French cities. I remind you that there are 6.5 million Muslims in Western Europe, 24 million Muslims in the whole of Europe, including European Russia. And in a situation like that, in a sense, it's a judgment on the Christian society and the Western society, where people have opted out of living together. The last category, very quickly, is those Muslims who live as minorities in alongside other neighbours, but who have this image of maybe a secular state providing the best policies of sharing with their neighbours. And here one thinks especially of the enormous number of Muslims in India. There are now more Muslims in India than Muslims in Pakistan, more Muslims in India than Muslims in Bangladesh. And many of these Muslims are there deliberately. They could have gone to Pakistan, they could have gone to Bangladesh, but many of them chose to stay and believe that their way of living their Islamic faith in the modern world is to live alongside neighbours and to have, they hope, a government which will give freedom of religion across the board to everybody, but will not impose or privilege any one religion. Unfortunately, their dreams are sometimes shattered by rabid Hindu nationalists and sometimes soured by cynical Christians, who I'm afraid there's some in India as well as other places. The last place perhaps to mention of the secular model is, of course, the Soviet Union. I remind you that there are there perhaps 50 or 60 million Muslims living in the Soviet Union. They have lived, most of them, the whole of their lives under a Soviet government. They've seen what, in their terms, is an economic revolution. They've seen what, in their terms, is a political revolution which has given them freedom from the old autocracies and feudalism under which they once lived. They've also seen, and I remind you this, that they have been allowed as Muslims in independent Soviets, a sort of federal structure which has given them a freedom that they never had under the Holy Roman, so Holy Russian Empire. And that Muslims today have a much more recognized position, have much freer position, have state subsidies and so on and so forth, that they never had when it was the Holy Russian Empire. Well, we started late, we finished late, excuse me, but there really is no time for discussion today, but I'm still around for another about 16 hours in the village, so look for me under the bell, look for me near the coffee machine if you have further questions. Excuse me. Thank you.